think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
I'm John Batchelor with Charles Spicer, the author of Coffee with Hitler, the untold story of the amateur spies who tried to civilize the Nazis. The war spills out across Europe, across Asia, around the world. The catastrophe, the deaths of tens of millions of people, the brutality and the sadism, but the war is ended. And the Nuremberg trials are begin. Von Ribbentrop is captured. Goering is captured. And Hess is in custody, has been since July of 1940. Himmler commits suicide. Hitler, of course, committed suicide. But the trial at Nuremberg is a first draft telling of who was responsible and how guilty. And Charles spends time with it, and we will too, because there are revelations at the trial that are important to understand the historical record as presented afterwards. This is the three men who are especially in the witness box together, Ribbentrop, Goering, and Hess. Charles writes they're all had good World War I records, but have all participated in some fashion in the brutality. They will all be convicted. There is not a doubt of their guilt. And yet, we begin with von Ribbentrop. You emphasize, Charles, how he looks to have had a nervous breakdown because he let himself go, he let his cell go, and he was in despair. He, in the witness box, was, you characterized him as muddled, but he wanted to call a lot of witnesses, including our principals, and to explain what. What was his thinking? What rationalization did he have, given what we've touched on was his threats to millions of human beings?
He's hoping to use his efforts in the late 30s to engender a treaty or an alliance between Germany and Great Britain. He's trying to use that as his defense, that he was a reasonable individual and he wasn't a war criminal.
He talks about the fellowship. He talks about the people he met through the fellowship, how his ambassadorship in London was meant to open up roads between Berlin and London. And therein is a mystery. It comes up again and again, because that's what it looked like, Charles, up until Ribbentrop changed his mind. And we've touched on this when we talked before. Is there an explanation for why the Ribbentrops reversed course and turned away from London and became... they hated the English after they turned.
I think because they felt snubbed by them. And even after he's dead, Ribbentrop's widow is trying to justify some of their social behavior in 36, 37 in London. He was famously nicknamed von Brickendrop by the British press. And it sounds almost trivial or almost facetious to put it like this, but it was a sense of the British taking the mickey, as we would say. They're not taking them seriously, not treating them with respect. There were silly tricks played on them, and the newspapers would be not always respectful about the Ribbentrops. And they both were very thin-skinned.
You make it very clear that Ribbentrop is guilty, 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 guilty of anti-Semitism, guilty of ordering the lynching of American and British pilots who were captured, of vouchsafing the mass exterminations, all of that makes him guilty. But in his mind, he'd worked for peace or worked for an accommodation. And he talked like this in the witness stand. So we move, and he even wanted to talk, he wanted the king of King George as a character witness. He wanted Churchill as a character witness. He wanted Van Sittart. And I believe he named Christie and Conwell Evans. Is that correct? They were not called.
He named Conwell Evans and Tennant, yes, but they were not deemed well enough. And of course, it's irrelevant. I mean, he wasn't wrong. He had tried in that period. He was trying for a good relations between the two countries, but that would in no way vindicate his involvement with the war crimes of wartime Nazi Germany. It was an irrelevance.
And Goering, his presentation on the witness stand was Arch Goering. He was on both sides at the same time and was not in any way rattled by the prosecution. The prosecutor in this case was Associate Justice Jackson. Eventually, the court didn't listen to any of Goering's pleading. This is a man who attempted to talk his way out of Hades, and he committed suicide the night before he was to be hanged. I mentioned Rudolf Hess for the little detail that you provide that's wonderful. He insisted on wearing his flying boots in the witness box. What was that meant to represent? What was he trying to say?
Oh, you'd have to have asked him that. I think it was he was just proud of his status as an airman, I would guess. The rest of them were wearing carpet slippers.
However, he did plan the Night of the Long Knives, which is how our story began. It was Tennant at dinner with von Ribbentrop. And Himmler who left the dinner to go out and execute the Night of the Long Knives. And Hess was part of that planning. And so all three are condemned. Hess is condemned to life in prison. He eventually commits suicide in his 90s, hanging himself, I believe, over a chair in the one place he could read. Von Ribbentrop is hanged 16 October 1946. And you mentioned the detail that the hangman's knot does not work and he struggles for breath for some time. I winced a little bit, but then I wondered if it was on purpose. Annalise writes memoirs. This is the widow. I'm surprised that she wasn't also prosecuted, given that she was materially involved in the conduct of the dictator and the success of her husband as a prime minister. What does she say in her memoir that rationalizes his conduct?
Well, it's actually his memoir, but she finishes it off after he's died. And she adds, she tries to clarify that the pre-war furore surrounding his social gaffes, particularly he gave the Hitler salute to George VI. And there's one incident when he failed to remove his hat in the royal presence and the garden party, and the British press were critical of that. And my point is that it indicates the extent to which, you know, she and her husband were deranged, that, you know, there'd been 6 years of war. Europe has been devastated, maybe 75 million people dead. The Third Reich has collapsed. And these two imbeciles are still worrying about social niceties, like whether a hat was taken off all those years before. I mean, it's absurd, but it gives you some insight into their mental derangement.
Well, I welcomed it, Charles, because while they were clearly wicked, I imagined them as human size, but this puts them down to about an inch high.
Yes.
The bitterness of it. Now we move over to the other side of the coin, which is London, the so-called ministries trial. And Charles raises a mystery. Van Sittart denies the cults, connections that he had with all of the Germans who were attempting to unseat Hitler or at least offer an alternative. And you write, Charles, that it remains a mystery why Van Sittart would change the record or not acknowledge it. Do we understand why now, these years later?
Well, I think the suggestion is that it's so uncomfortable, this is what Patricia Meehan argues in her book, The Unnecessary War, that it was so uncomfortable for the Foreign Office, for the diplomats in London, to look back at some of these perhaps chaotic conversations with potential alternatives to Hitler's regime, and admit that if they'd been more energetic, the war might have been prevented. And many historians in the 60s and 70s essentially colluded with that approach. It was just too awkward to think that if we had taken a slightly different approach. And so they sort of reversed, they pushed backwards the Churchillian concept that there was only one way to deal with the Nazis, and that was total war, because it was just too horrific to think that there might have been an alternative.
Halifax did acknowledge the work of Van Sittard's amateur spies, did acknowledge CE, did acknowledge the courts. Good for Halifax. The Christie was always a great risk. It's striking to me how much the Oster conspiracy of 38, 39, at least the original concept, you know, a panzer division showing up and the police cooperating and going right to the Reichschancellery and putting the dictator under arrest or just shooting him, how much that resembles Operation Valkyrie, which has had a movie made. It's striking, almost as if it was the same group.
Many of the same people were involved in both. The Valkyrie one is much much better known, not just because of the film, but it's always had much more focus on it, which to my mind is wrong, because the 38 one would have been much more effective. even if the bomb plot had succeeded, let's face it, most of Hitler's damage had already been done by then. He was already losing the war.
And the Fellowship, implicit in all this, is that the Fellowship was a bad direction. I believe that would be Van Sittard's way of disdaining all of this. But Van Sittard attended Fellowship events. Halifax, I made a detail in your telling. Halifax was asked by CE, should we continue? And Halifax said yes. So all of the major politicians blessed the Fellowship right up until May of 1940.
Absolutely. But during the war, just being a member or having attended any of its events is so open to misinterpretation. It's so embarrassing. Even though it was a perfectly respectable organization, it gets brushed under the carpet. And that's really been the essence of my entire historical research, is to pull those fragments back up from under the carpet, put them back together, and try and figure out what it was all about.
None So Blind is the book we're going to explicate when we come back. It is a revelation. The book is Coffee with Hitler. Charles Spicer is the author. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.